Thank you, Nitya. Yeah, so I'll tell you just the results today coming from our new Latte suite of simulations. And I'll just say this is work that's been done with the FHIR collaboration, so I'll be highlighting results of a lot of other members of the collaboration as we go along. And just for reference, this is actually an image from within one of these Milky Way simulations. We're looking into the galactic center at about the solar circle. So just to show a movie of what one of these galaxies looks like, this is the evolution of one of these cosmologic zoom-in simulations of a Milky Way mass galaxy evolved over the last roughly 1 billion years of its evolution. So you can see as we fly through the satellite population here, we're seeing a stellar halo here. This particular Milky Way happens to be undergoing a merger right around, right before redshift zero here with a SMC mass satellite. We're flying through the stream at the moment. We're gonna go in on the disk. You can see the clumpy star forming regions here. You can see as we zoom out the spiral-like structure and the stellar distribution. And then you can see this 100 kiloparsec long tidal tail that's formed at least from this particular merger here, along with small resolved star clusters in one of these streams. And then as we keep zooming out, you can see, of course, the shells also generated during the merger processes in addition to these satellite populations. So just a brief outline of my talk. I'll talk to you a little bit about the FHIR physics model. I'll just touch briefly on the formation of the central disk galaxy. And then most of what I'll discuss will be on the population of satellites that forms around the host. So of course, this is all part of the FHIR collaboration with the FHIR model. So again, the goal with these zoom-in simulations is to push as high resolution as we can to try to start to resolve dense multi-phase interstellar medium. So for the Latte simulations, at least, we're getting down to baryonic mass resolution of 7,000. Our gas softening is now fully adaptive. And so the typical resolution scale in the ISM is about 20 to 30 parsecs, although in the central regions of some of these mitre clouds, it's getting all the way down to one parsec. And so we include gas cooling, including molecules and metals down to 10 Kelvin. And I want to emphasize an important aspect of our model, at least in our view, is that star formation happens in self-gravitating molecular clouds at relatively high gas densities, for at least for cosmological simulations. Of course, we also try to include what we think are the most important, at least stellar feedback processes in these simulations. So caveat, we have not yet included any AGN feedback. So this includes supernova, both core collapse and type 1a. This includes stellar winds from massive O stars and late stage AGB stars. Photoionization, so driving H2 regions, as well as photoelectric heating. And we're trying to explicitly model momentum input in addition to thermal energy input. This includes radiation pressure from massive stars. This includes the momentum from supernova ejecta. And then this also includes momentum from stellar winds. And we've heard a lot at this meeting about various simulation groups and updates that have been going on. So we now also have an update to the FHIR model we're calling FHIR 2. And we just put this paper out a few months ago. 66 pages, so I'm sure you've all read it from cover to cover. But our goal, in part, was to try to put all aspects of the FHIR model in one paper. So if you want to know what's in FHIR, you can look at this paper and get essentially all of the critical aspects to the model. We also did a lot of numerical tests I don't have time to describe today, effects of different feedback processes, effects of varying resolution. And we also described some of the updates to FHIR compared to the earlier version. I just want to highlight the two that we think are the most important. So first of all, we've changed the hydrodynamics method we're using. So we're no longer using SPH. We're now using a very nice mesh-free finite mass method. This is a meshless Godunov method that Phil Hopkins developed. It's a very nice method, and it's tested in a wide variety of problems, giving performance probably most similar to a moving mesh code. And then somewhat detailed, I don't have time to discuss now, but I'm happy to discuss anyone. We've also updated the way that feedback is coupled to the surrounding ISM in this model. So we're not changing the underlying energetics or the momentum, but just trying to make sure that the deposition itself is more geometrically aware and trying to ensure that its injection is isotropic, because sort of simplistic ways of doing this we found could lead to issues, especially when predictions for the morphologies of massive galaxies. And again, I'm happy to talk with anyone after the talk about that. All right, so on to the formation of the Milky Way-like disk galaxies themselves. I think Shay already showed a version of this. This just shows an example from one of our simulated galaxies. This is a face-on and edge-on image of the disk at redshift zero. So stellar mass actually quite comparable to the Milky Way. And I want to highlight, as you can see here, the relatively thin disk morphology, actually thin embedded in a relatively thick disk. So this just shows the same disk. And we're going to look at the vertical structure of the disk measured at the solar circle. So this is a paper led by a graduate student, Shengsheng Ma. He's actually finishing next year. He's a fantastic student, finishing up at Caltech. And so he looked at the stellar density profile as a function of vertical height in the disk. That's the black curves here measured in this simulation. And you can see that it's well fit by a two-component profile, a thin disk component and a thick disk component. And the scale heights of these individual components, thin disk of 300 parsec, thick disk of just over a kiloparsec, are actually quite consistent with what's measured in the Milky Way. So there's actually no problem in these models of forming thin disks, despite the feedback that's put in. And we think part of it has to do with going to high enough resolution that you're starting to resolve the venting of winds off of the disk, so you can actually keep cool gas into the disk. And I just want to add to that briefly, we haven't talked a lot about disk structure yet in the meeting, but I think this is actually an evolving view that's actually a lot of convergence across different simulation groups, just highlighting a few here. Apologies if I've missed other folks who have looked at this. Is sort of the way that thin plus thick disk formation happens is actually emerging quite naturally now in these cosmological simulations. So if you look at the stellar disk back 10 gigayears ago, right, it's as a result of a very turbulent ISM, results in a very thick disk or spheroidal-ish component. Stars are actually forming in a semi-dispersion supported way. And then as that disk settles down over cosmic time, right, this is at late times is when this thin disk starts forming. So this is a very natural way cosmologically to get a thin plus thick disk component. At least in this particular case study we studied, we found that this was the dominant mode of the generation of the thick disk, was in situ formation as opposed to necessarily post-formation heating or migration. This is the stars here. And so one way to think about disk formation, I think, I know Jonathan Bird has described it this way, is in terms of the radial evolution of the disk is certainly inside out, but actually the vertical formation of the disk turns out to be more of an upside down phenomenon. So that's all the time I have to say about disk formation. I want to jump ahead to looking more at the satellite population that forms here. So as Shay already described, we finished running three of these Milky Way mass resolution simulations here, Latte, Flat White, and Macchiato. And I'll just show you here the host virial masses of these systems. So they sit basically between 1 and 2 by 10 to the 12. And so Shay already sort of stole my thunder, but that's okay. So here is the stellar mass function, cumulative stellar mass function, measured around both the Milky Way and around Andromeda, or M31, as a function of stellar mass of the satellite populations that sit within 300 kiloparsec. So these are the observations. I just actually want to step back and acknowledge for a moment, there is, people don't always appreciate it, there's a factor of 2 to 2.5 difference in the numbers of satellites around M31 as compared to the Milky Way. And then if I overplot here the results from these three Milky Way mass simulations, we're able to resolve satellite dwarf galaxies now down to a stellar masses of about 10 to the 5. We see essentially these three essentially bracket what's measured around the Milky Way and around M31. So Latte is in the middle, we have Flat White more consistent with the Milky Way, and we have Macchiato here up consistent with M31. And I just want to emphasize, we had no pre-selection of these hosts on satellite population, on formation history. We were intentionally trying to be blind to any aspects of their formation history other than selection based off of their virial mass. And of course, another caveat is so far we've just done individual isolated Milky Ways. These aren't local group-like analogs, but that is something that Shay is working on as well. All right, so at least when I look at this plot and I see the stellar mass function down to 10 to the 5, you can come to your own conclusions, but looking at this, I certainly wouldn't claim to see any missing satellites problem, at least again down to our, where I trust our simulations, down to about stellar mass of 10 to the 5. Similarly, we can look at the velocity dispersions of the stars that form in these dwarf galaxies. So this is essentially the too big to fail problem, which is a statement about the central densities of dwarf galaxies at a given mass. And so again, the cumulative number of satellite galaxies is a function of their measured stellar velocity dispersion. This is estimating their 3D velocity dispersion. Again, around the Milky Way and M31, again, about a factor of 2 offset. And then again, here's the results from the three Milky Way simulations we finished. So again, Flat White is actually quite similar to the Milky Way. Latte sits in the middle. Macchiato has a little bit excess here, but it's, you know, a factor of few at a given velocity dispersion. So again, at least down to velocity dispersions of about, let's say, 7 or 8 kilometers per second, looking at these figures, I wouldn't claim to see any big discrepancies. There's no clear too big to fail problem, at least from these simulations. So we can look at more detailed aspects of the satellite populations, how they actually form. So we can look at their star formation histories. And so one nice thing about the local group and the satellites, the Milky Way in particular, is we can observe them with resolved stellar populations, and we can actually back out fairly robust star formation histories. So this is nice work from Dan Wise a few years ago. So this is the cumulative fraction of stars formed normalized to stellar mass today, so putting everything normalized to one today, as a function of if you want to think in look-back time or if you want to think in redshift. And so these are the massive, these are classical dwarf spheroidals around the Milky Way. These are observed star formation histories here. And of course, the interesting thing here is the wide diversity of star formation histories that are measured for the population of at least classical dwarfs around the Milky Way. And then I'm going to put these in the background and overplot the results from the LOTTE simulation here. And so you can see the formation histories of these dwarfs are also quite consistent with the diversity of histories that are observed for the satellites around the Milky Way. So we have early forming halos here, and we have relatively late forming systems here. Also, the mass dependence is, it's you can sort of see from this panel that the fainter dwarfs tend to have turned off at higher redshift, the more massive dwarfs. Actually, the most massive sort of SMC mass satellite here actually remains star forming, essentially down to redshift zero. So the mass dependence of the star formation histories is also consistent. Essentially, all of the dwarf spheroidals around the Milky Way, other than the small and large Magellanic Cloud, are quenched. They're spheroidals, they have no gas today. And it's actually consistent with these simulations. All of these satellites here are quenched except for the more massive one. Although I think Marla is about to throw a monkey wrench into this picture, that maybe we don't expect all of these classical satellite mass systems to be quenched in other Milky Way mass systems, but we'll hear more from her. So coming back to sort of the big questions in the field, missing satellites problem, too big to fail problem, related perhaps the core cusp problem. So one way of asking the question is, can a cold dark matter based model produce a population of satellites that have the observed distribution of stellar masses? Seems to be yes. In terms of the too big to fail or core cusp problem, it's a statement about the densities of these dwarfs. So can a cold dark matter based model produce satellite populations with the observed distribution of, as is measured, the stellar velocity dispersions? And as I showed you, we're getting results that are quite consistent. And I want to emphasize, it's not just us. So nice work from Allison and Adi Zolotov a few years ago. I think we'll hear in a moment from Carlos about results from the Apostle simulations. You know, we may quibble about some aspects of the galaxy formation models and feedback, but a wide variety of groups now are getting results for these dwarf galaxy populations that are broadly consistent with what's observed. And Allison also nicely showed in terms of the more distant field populations in terms of their gas kinematics. So I think there's growing consensus here that a lot of these classical problems, when we look at high enough resolution simulations with enough of the baryonic physics, we're getting populations of dwarf galaxies that are agreeing reasonably well, at least, with the observations. So I just want to revisit why it is that we're seeing good agreement now as compared with, say, dark matter-only predictions for these populations. So what causes, one way of asking the question is, what causes a lack of massive satellite dwarf galaxies in these Milky Way mass hosts? So the first answer you actually already heard very nicely from Shay's talk, just adding in a central galaxy, forget the complex hydrodynamic star formation stellar feedback, just adding in the mass and size of the central galaxy, and it's really not that sensitive, it's a disk, if it's an elliptical, destroys a lot of the satellites that orbit near it, right? And I just want to emphasize this just in graphical form, Shay already showed this, but you see the differences by eye in the distribution of dark matter in the central 100 kiloparsecs of a dark matter-only simulation, and the exact same system simulated with full baryonic physics, or equivalently to within 10% simulated with just a disk potential. So these are not subtle differences in the inner regions. These are factors of several differences in predicted subhalo abundances. So for anyone still so if you're using dark matter only to make predictions of substructure on small scales, at least for Milky Way mass systems, I think this is a huge caveat. Also the UV background, and the way we talk about this, or the way we often talk about this in its effect on dwarf galaxies, we often talk about rainization and how it tends to wash away low-mass satellites that may have never formed stars. But I just want to emphasize, it's already been mentioned, but I want to reemphasize, the UV background all the way down to redshift zero has a big effect in regulating the star formation efficiencies, even of more massive dwarf systems. So let me just show you a simple test of this from our recent FIRE methods paper. So here's an individual dwarf galaxy, not a satellite. And here it shows its stellar mass growth as a function here of scale factor. So just look at the black curve is our standard FIRE feedback model. So this is a dwarf in a halo of viral mass about 10 to the 10. It forms a stellar mass of a few by 10 to the 6. If we just turn off the UV background completely, you know, this is a relatively massive dwarf, stellar mass cubed by 10 to the 6. Yes, it overestimates the stellar mass formed back at the time of reionization, but it also significantly continues to overestimate the stellar mass formed at late redshift. So here we get a factor of 10 overestimate in the stellar mass of this dwarf, just turning off the UV background. It's not just reionization effects, it's late time effects of the UV background on affecting the gas cooling into one of these dwarfs. So I think, you know, one thing as we think more carefully about modeling dwarf galaxies, this point was already raised, is we need to be thinking more carefully about the accuracy of our global UV background model, and also what the effects of spatial variations in the UV background may have as we look at different dwarf galaxy populations, both in the local group and beyond. So in this case, the UV background is redshift dependent, but spatially uniform. So, you know, again, that's a simple way of putting it in, but, you know, even that has a huge effect. Even that, the most simple way of putting the UV background changes the predicted stellar mass by a factor of 10. And so the last thing is, in terms of regulating the central densities of at least the more massive dwarf galaxies, is stellar feedback in these models. And again, the picture is stellar feedback in our model leads to bursty star formation, which drives strong gas outflows and inflows that tend to heat the orbits of the dark matter, and they reduce the inner densities forming cores. So just to show you a nice sort of example of trying to zoom in on the mass dependence of this more carefully, this is a paper led by Alex Fitz. He's a student working with Mike Boylan-Colchin at UT Austin right now. And so he had a nice suite of about a dozen individual dwarf galaxy systems he simulated with FIRE, all had the same virial mass at redshift 0, 10 to the 10. But they had actually a range of stellar masses at redshift 0 as well. And so if you look at the dark matter density profile, it's a function of radius here. So the lowest mass dwarfs here that form stellar mass below about 10 to the 6, basically the dark matter profile in the baryonic run and the dark matter run were essentially similar. It's only when you start forming something like 10 to the 6 or a few by 10 to the 6 stars that we start seeing the coring effects from baryons kick in. And of course, as you form more stars, the effect is stronger. And again, this is, I think, just reinforcing a lot of nice work over the last several years on this. And again, just to emphasize this more, again, this is taken from Alex Fitz's sample. Again, all of these dwarfs have virial mass 10 to the 10 at redshift 0. And this shows, as a function of their stellar mass, what the reduction of their inner density is measured, essentially the density measured within 500 parsecs. So just one point I think was quite interesting from this sample, again, very narrow halo mass range. You can see the distribution of stellar masses that were formed here. So we actually see a factor of plus and minus 10 in the predicted stellar masses. The scatter, at least in this particular sample, is actually quite large. And the amount of coring correlates quite nicely with just the amount of stars formed. So once you get above about 10 to the 6 is when you start having significant reductions in the inner dark matter density. And the way this happens, again, a lot of this process has been outlined nicely in previous papers just to reinforce it. Again, our simulations and many other simulations of high-resolution dwarf galaxies predict that they would have very bursty star formation. So this just shows specific star formation rate as a function of time in just one of our dwarf galaxies, and you can see how much star formation rates are changing over the course of even just a few hundred million years here. And you know, this isn't just in the simulation. There's actually nice observational evidence that we think dwarf galaxies do have bursty star formations. This is a result. This is comparing to observations from Dan Wise of several years ago. So you can look, for instance, at the ratio of the H alpha base star formation rate to the UV star formation rate. So H alpha is tracing star formation on something like 10 million years. UV is tracing star formation on something like 100 million years. And so the ratio gives you some estimate of the burstiness. So the fact that this isn't zero means that there is burstiness. The black point curve here, if you just look at the black region, is essentially the observations of Dan Wise. And then the nice paper of Martin Spahr a few years ago from FIRE, these gray points show the prediction from FIRE. So I wouldn't say there's necessarily exact agreement, but the broad statement here is that the observations point to bursty star formation that at least qualitatively is in at least our FIRE model and a wide variety of these other zoom-in simulations. And so what this tends to do is a bursty star formation drives gas out on short time scales. It's not an adiabatic process. Therefore, you systematically heat the orbits of the dark matter. And one aspect of this I want to emphasize that isn't always appreciated, this is nice work of Karim Albadri, who's sitting right there. I strongly encourage you to talk to him. He's a first-year graduate student at Berkeley who's doing really nice work. So again, if we look at one of our dwarf galaxies and we look at the specific star formation rate versus time, right? So here's the burstiness here, that this burstiness feedback-induced coring effect doesn't predict just a single slope of the density profile in one of these dwarfs. the slope of the density profile changes as the gas comes in and out. And so there's no monolithic exact slope. We actually predict that over the course of time, these dwarf galaxies should go from actually cusps to cores, depending on where they are in this burst cycle as the gas is coming in and out and deepening and shallowing the potential with it. The other interesting aspect from Karim's paper is that the stars are actually responding in much the same way as the dark matter. They're also getting puffed out. And so if you look at the galaxy size over time, that one of these dwarf galaxies, I think this dwarf has a stellar mass of a few by 10 to the 8, is changing in size over the course of just a few hundred million years by factors of 2 and 3. The stars are actually doing this as well. And this has a lot of interesting implications because it means that things like galaxy size, stellar kinematics, and dark matter coring all should correlate with star formation activity and gas kinematics. And so just to phrase this a different way, this is a more recent paper of his, again, trying to push this more into the observational realm. Again, the specific star formation rate versus cosmic time. The blue points here show the specific star formation rate, and the red curve here shows the measured stellar line of sight velocity dispersion. And you can see how nicely they're correlated here. And again, if you look at the coring of the slope of the central density profile, again, they're nicely anti-correlated. And so if you just sample one of these galaxies through its history, what you see is, I think, an honest prediction of this model and will have to be true if we believe this feedback-induced coring of inducing dark matter cores in these dwarf galaxies, is that we should see an observed correlation between recent star formation activity and measured sizes or velocity dispersions in one of these dwarf galaxies. So this is an honest-to-goodness prediction that I don't think has been tested observationally yet, but I think will be a useful test of this model. So I just want to say in passing, another interesting aspect of this is some of these dwarf galaxies can get sizes that are quite large, and this actually connects quite nicely with a lot of the so-called ultra-diffuse galaxies that have been discovered recently. And so T.K. Chan, he's a student at UC San Diego, is finishing up a paper here. I think there's also a nice paper from Arianna DeCintio recently finding similar things. But just pointing out that during these burst phases, or at least during the more rarefied phases, the sizes and surface brightnesses of some of these, again, these are just individual isolated dwarf galaxies, have surface brightnesses and sizes that are actually quite consistent with these ultra-diffuse galaxies in coma. So again, another prediction of this model is this perhaps can account for the ultra-diffuse galaxies, but we should also see them in the field, not just in dense environments, and their sizes should correlate with metrics of recent star formation activity. So that's the end of my talk. I'll just stop there. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
This is great stuff. Just a question about this last statement that you predicted this correlation between velocity dispersion and sizes and star formation rate. Such a statement has to be made at a certain control variable.
So that's
a fixed stellar mass. It's not clear that will work. Do you think you can identify right?
One way we've thought about it is at fixed, if you could have a sample of field galaxies within the 100 megaparsecs, that you had really good measurements of stellar mass, and you could find a really narrow stellar mass selected sample, then you will see correlations between star formation activity and velocity dispersion.
But I would argue that at a given stellar mass, surface density, for example, is more important for setting the star formation rate. So even without this effect,
but I guess the point is it should correlate with not just long-term star formation metrics, but short-term star formation metrics. I agree. I think we have to tease this out more carefully, but I think this is at least a path forward for testing the model. You raise, there are subtleties here. I appreciate it. That's right. And we played with it, but that's not in these models. That's plausible. I think it depends on how frequent they are. If you just have one or two, it may or may not be dynamically, because again, this whole method of these breathing modes driving core formation relies on this happening many times over Hubble time. So if it's one or two, it's not obvious to me how big of an effect it'll have at redshift zero. But if it happens, order 10 plus times in the Hubble time, it may be dynamically more important.
So Andrew, I actually also have a question about these ultra-diffuse dwarfs, which I think are pretty interesting. So in this calculation, they come from these sort of breathing modes of the galaxy, essentially. And so in principle, you wouldn't actually expect you wouldn't actually expect that to actually matter if it was in a dense environment or a less dense environment because it's sort of internally generated. Have you just looked at even a simple case of embedding these in a, you know, just in an overdensity or anything?
Yeah,
like that?
So I'll just, so these have mostly been discovered in dense environments. It's not obvious, at least to me, how much of this is a selection effect. That's easier to find, you know, large numbers of galaxies around Coma or Virgo. And people are looking out the field, and I've, you know, I think there are some detections out to lower density environments. In our view, the sort of the way to interpret this scenario is before they fell in, right, before, as they were still gas rich and star forming, these breathing modes were happening. You fall into the cluster, over some time scale, your gas gets stripped out, perhaps Ram pressure stripping. That acts as the last hurrah. You can take the potential and really shallow it forevermore, and you get stuck out in a rarefied stage. So we're not yet able to resolve self-consistently these dwarfs in a cluster environment, but we can at least sort of take them and then put them through a Ram pressure wind that perhaps we think would, at least as a toy model, mimic a cluster environment, the Ram pressure you'd experience in a cluster environment. So that's part of this paper now, is trying to do those tests and seeing how it actually predicts these things would get frozen in. You know, there are additional subtleties with tidal interactions, but at least we can step our way, you know, there. Yeah, we
work out the rain, and that's observational.
Right.
It looks like you're finding great new stochastic behavior.
Yes. Well, I think it's related in the sense of, you know, it's very narrow. These are all 10 to the 10, and we see, you know. So perhaps we see, it's unclear actually, again, this isn't, I don't know that we have the statistics yet to slice things very carefully. I think it would be interesting to revisit this of, you know, comparing how much scatter we see at a given mass compared to any of the other predictions. But I think another way of saying it is we also expect to the degree that there is scatter in properties like stellar mass, that should correlate with secondary properties like central density, like star formation history, like, you know, size fluctuations, et cetera.
So it would be interesting then to do something like this again at 38 solar masses and see if you see even more stars.
Yeah. So that's part of what we're trying to do now. Yeah.
So on your correlation with the recent star formation rate that you discussed in the last slides, I was under the impression that the fire simulations and also the simulations we do with gasoline and also some of those that romanticize does with AMR, with Ramses, they still broadly agree on the fact that you have a sweet spot in stellar mass. We have a lot of scatter, of course, but there is a sweet spot between 10 to the 7, 10 to the 10.
I completely agree.
Right, so I guess my point is that's a second parameter. The stellar mass is an important parameter, right? So you then how does it combined with the correlation that you're showing, because you can't just correlate with the recent star formation, but you have to correlate also with the total stellar mass,
right,
if that other correlation is true.
So that kind of comes back to Frank's question. I think you'd want to do this, if you could do it, you design the observation, take a narrow stellar mass, you're comparing things at fixed stellar mass, because coming back here, I completely agree with you, as you go down to stellar masses that are below 10 to the 6,
right,
you don't have core formation, you don't have that level of burstiness that, so this would have, I think this test would be at the masses where the models predict core formation, and you have to limit the tests to very narrow mass bins to compare galaxies to do for the reasons I think that you just described.
But you also have to be sure you don't take any Sabelo, right? Because otherwise, stellar mass is not a good proxy anymore.
Yeah, I think this would be, so for the subhalos that also get stripped of gas and aren't star forming, again,
yeah,
you wouldn't see the burstiness
right
anymore because they're basically frozen
right
in. So ideally, this would be samples of, you know,
field,
low mass galaxies,
field,
10 to the 8, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 9. In the local, you know, in the local universe.
Hi, Shani Danieli from Yale. So back to UDGs, do you see large number of globular clusters in some of the UDGs? Because we do observe up to 80 in Dragonfly 44.
Yeah. Yeah, we were talking about this over lunch. Actually, we had a paper led by Ji-hoon Kim a few weeks ago. I think that we see hints of globular cluster formation, but I think this is very sensitive to resolution. So we had very high resolution simulations we could run just down to redshift 5. And as Ji-hoon showed in his paper, we're actually seeing plausible globular cluster-like candidates forming at those redshifts. At this resolution of the simulations we have down to redshift 0, I'm not sure yet I trust their ability to, perhaps they can form globulars, but then you worry about numerical dissipation because of finite spatial and mass resolution. So I'm not sure we're quite there yet to really use globulars as a metric in these simulations, because I'm not sure I trust yet our ability to form them, at least down to low redshifts.
All right. Let's thank Andrew again for his discussion.